Part 2, Interpersonal Rethinking, Opening Other People's Minds. Chapter 5, Dances with Foes, How to Win Debates and Influence People. Exhausting someone in argument is not the same as convincing him. Tim Kreider. At 31, Harish Natarajan has won 36 international debate tournaments. He's been told it's a world record. But his opponent today presents a unique challenge. Deborah Jo Prechtet is a prodigy hailing from Haifa, Israel. She's just 8 years old, and although she made her first foray into public debating only last summer, she's been preparing for this moment for years. Deborah has absorbed countless articles to accumulate knowledge, closely studied speechwriting to hone her clarity, and even practiced her delivery to incorporate humor. Now she's ready to challenge the champion himself. Her parents are hoping she'll make history. Harish was a wunderkind too. By the time he was 8, he was outmaneuvering his own parents in dinner table debates about the Indian caste system. He went on to become the European debate champion and a grand finalist in the World Debate Championship, and coached the Filipino national school debate team at the World Championship. I was introduced to Harish by an unusually bright former student who used to compete against him and remembers having lost, quote, many, likely all, of their debates. Harish and Deborah are facing off in San Francisco in February 2019 in front of a large crowd. They've been kept in the dark about the debate topic. When they walk on stage, the moderator announces the subject. Should preschools be subsidized by the government? After just 15 minutes of preparation, Deborah will present her strongest arguments in favor of subsidies, and Harish will marshal his best case against them. Their goal is to win the audience over to their side on preschool subsidies, but their impact on me will be much broader. They'll end up changing my view of what it takes to win a debate. Deborah kicks off with a joke, drawing laughter from the crowd by telling Harish that although he may hold the world record in debate wins, he's never debated someone like her. Then she goes on to summarize an impressive number of studies, citing her sources, about the academic, social, and professional benefits of preschool programs. For good measure, she quotes a former prime minister's argument about preschool being a smart investment. Harish acknowledges the facts that Deborah presented, but then makes his case that subsidizing preschools is not the appropriate remedy for the damage caused by poverty. He suggests that the issue should be evaluated on two grounds: whether preschool is currently underprovided and underconsumed, and whether it helps those who are the least fortunate. He argues that in a world full of trade-offs, subsidizing preschool is not the best use of taxpayer money. Going into the debate, 92% of the audience has already made up their minds. I'm one of them. It didn't take me long to figure out where I stood on preschool subsidies. In the United States, public education is free from kindergarten through high school. I'm familiar with evidence that early access to education in the first few years of children's lives may be even more critical to helping them escape poverty than anything they learn later. I believe education is a fundamental human right, like access to water, food, shelter, and healthcare. That puts me on Team Deborah. As I watch the debate, her early arguments strike a chord. Here are some highlights.
Research clearly shows that a good preschool can help kids overcome the disadvantages often associated with poverty.
Data for the win! Be still, my beating heart.
You will possibly hear my opponent talk today about different priorities. He might say that subsidies are needed, but not for preschools. I would like to ask you, Mr. Natarajan, why don't we examine the evidence and the data and decide accordingly?
If Harish has an Achilles heel, my former student has told me, it's that his brilliant arguments aren't always grounded in facts.
Let me start by examining the main claim. That if we believe preschools are good in principle, surely it's worth giving money to subsidize those. But I don't think that's ever enough of a justification for subsidies.
Deborah has clearly done her homework. She didn't just nail Harish on data. She anticipated his counterargument.
The state budget is a big one, and there is room in it to subsidize preschools and invest in other fields. Therefore, the idea that there are more important things to spend on is irrelevant because the different subsidies are not mutually exclusive.
Way to debunk Harish's case for trade-offs. Bravo.
Maybe the state has the budget to do all the good things. Maybe the state has the budget to provide health care. Maybe it has the budget to provide welfare payments. Maybe it has the budget to provide running water as well as preschools. I would love to live in that world. But I don't think that is the world we live in. I think we live in a world where there are real constraints on what governments can spend money on. And even if those are not real, they are nonetheless political.
Dope!
Valid point. Even if a program has the potential to pay for itself, it takes a lot of political capital to make it happen. Capital that could be invested elsewhere.
Giving opportunities to the less fortunate should be a moral obligation of any human being, and it is a key role for the state. To be clear, we should find the funding for preschools and not rely on luck or market forces. This issue is too important to not have a safety net.
Yes! This is more than a political or an economic question. It's a moral question.
I want to start by noting what we agree on. We agree that poverty is terrible. It is terrible when individuals do not have running water. It is terrible when they are struggling to feed their family. It is terrible when they cannot get health care. That is all terrible. And those are all things we need to address. And none of those are addressed just because you are going to subsidize preschool. Why is that the case?
Can Deborah argue otherwise?
Universal full-day preschool creates significant economic savings in healthcare as well as decreased crime, welfare dependence, and child abuse.
High-quality preschools will reduce crime, maybe, but so would other measures in terms of crime prevention.
High-quality preschool boosts high school graduation rates.
High-quality preschools can lead to huge improvements in individuals' lives, maybe. But I'm not sure if you massively increase the number of people going to preschool, they're all going to be the ones going to the high-quality preschools.
Uh-oh. Harish is right. There's a risk that children from the poorest families will end up in the worst preschools. I'm starting to rethink my position.
Even when you subsidize preschools, it doesn't mean that all individuals go. The question is, who do you help? And the people you don't help are those individuals who are the poorest. You give unfair and exaggerated gains to those individuals who are in the middle class.
Point taken. Since preschool won't be free, the underprivileged still might not be able to afford it. Now I'm torn about where I stand. You've heard arguments from both sides. Before I tell you who won, consider your own position. What was your opinion of preschool subsidies going into the debate, and how many times did you end up rethinking that opinion? If you're like me, you reconsidered your views multiple times. Changing your mind doesn't make you a flip-flopper or a hypocrite. It means you were open to learning. Looking back, I'm disappointed in myself for forming an opinion before the debate even started. Sure, I'd read some research on early child development, but I was clueless about the economics of subsidies and the alternative ways those funds could be invested. Note to self, on my next trip to the top of Mount Stupid, remember to take a selfie. In the audience poll after the debate, the number of undecided people was the same, but the balance of opinion shifted away from Deborah's position toward Harish's. Support for preschool subsidies dropped from 79 to 62%, and opposition more than doubled from 13 to 30%. Deborah not only had more data, better evidence, and more evocative imagery, she had the audience on her side going into the debate. Yet Harish convinced a number of us to rethink our positions. How did he do it, and what can we learn from him about the art of debate? This section of the book is about convincing other people to rethink their opinions. When we're trying to persuade people, we frequently take an adversarial approach. Instead of opening their minds, we effectively shut them down or rile them up. They play defense by putting up a shield, play offense by preaching their perspectives and prosecuting ours, or play politics by telling us what we want to hear without changing what they actually think. I want to explore a more collaborative approach, one in which we show more humility and curiosity and invite others to think more like scientists. A few years ago, a former student named Jamie called me for advice on where to go to business school. Since she was already well on her way to building a successful career, I told her it was a waste of time and money. I walked her through the lack of evidence that a graduate degree would make a tangible difference in her future, and the risk that she'd end up overqualified and underexperienced. When she insisted that her employer expected an MBA for promotions, I told her that I knew of exceptions and pointed out that she probably wouldn't spend her whole career at that firm anyway. Finally, she hit back. "You're a logic bully." "A what?" "A logic bully," Jamie repeated. "You just overwhelm me with rational arguments, and I don't agree with them, but I can't fight back." At first, I was delighted by the label. It felt like a solid description of one of my roles as a social scientist, to win debates with the best data. Then Jamie explained that my approach wasn't actually helpful. The more forcefully I argued, the more she dug in her heels. Suddenly, I realized I had instigated that same kind of resistance many times before. Growing up, I was taught by my karate sensei never to start a fight unless I was prepared to be the only one standing at the end. That's how I approached debates at work and with friends. I thought the key to victory was to go into battle armed with airtight logic and rigorous data. The harder I attacked, though, the harder my opponents fought back. I was laser-focused on convincing them to accept my views and rethink theirs, but I was coming across like a preacher and a prosecutor. Although those mindsets sometimes motivated me to persist in making my points, I often ended up alienating my audience. I was not winning. For centuries, debating has been prized as an art form, but there's now a growing science of how to do it well. In a formal debate, your goal is to change the mind of your audience. In an informal debate, you're trying to change the mind of your conversation partner. That's a kind of negotiation where you're trying to reach an agreement about the truth. To build my knowledge and skills about how to win debates, I studied the psychology of negotiations and eventually used what I'd learned to teach bargaining skills to leaders across business and government. I came away convinced that my instincts and what I'd learned in karate were dead wrong. A good debate is not a war. It's not even a tug of war, where you can drag your opponent to your side if you pull hard enough on the rope. It's more like a dance that hasn't been choreographed, negotiated with a partner who has a different set of steps in mind. If you try too hard to lead, your partner will resist. If you can adapt your moves to hers and get her to do the same, you're more likely to end up in rhythm. In a classic study, a team of researchers led by Neil Rackham examined what expert negotiators do differently. They recruited one group of average negotiators and another group of highly skilled ones who had significant track records of success and had been rated as effective by their counterparts. To compare the participants' techniques, they recorded both groups doing labor and contract negotiations. In a war, our goal is to gain ground rather than lose it, so we're often afraid to surrender a few battles. In a negotiation, agreeing with someone else's argument is disarming. The experts recognized that in their dance, they couldn't stand still and expect the other person to make all the moves. To get in harmony, they needed to step back from time to time. One difference was visible before anyone even arrived at the bargaining table. Prior to the negotiations, the researchers interviewed both groups about their plans. The average negotiators went in armed for battle, hardly taking note of any anticipated areas of agreement. The experts, in contrast, mapped out a series of dance steps that they might be able to take with the other side, devoting more than a third of their planning comments to finding common ground. As the negotiators started discussing options and making proposals, a second difference emerged. Most people think of arguments as being like a pair of scales. The more reasons we can pile up on our side, the more it will tip the balance in our favor. Yet the experts did the exact opposite. They actually presented fewer reasons to support their case. They didn't want to water down their best points. As Rackham put it, a weak argument generally dilutes a strong one. The more reasons we put on the table, the easier it is for people to discard the shakiest one. Once they reject one of our justifications, they can easily dismiss our entire case. That happened regularly to the average negotiators. They brought too many different weapons to battle. They lost ground not because of the strength of their most compelling point, but because of the weakness of their least compelling one. These habits led to a third contrast. The average negotiators were more likely to enter into defend attack spirals. They dismissively shot down their opponents' proposals and doubled down on their own positions, which prevented both sides from opening their minds. the skilled negotiators rarely went on offense or defense. Instead, they expressed curiosity with questions like, "So you don't see any merit in this proposal at all?" Questions were the fourth difference between the two groups. Of every five comments the experts made, at least one ended in a question mark. They appeared less assertive, but much like in a dance, they led by letting their partners step forward. Recent experiments show that having even one negotiator who brings a scientist's level of humility and curiosity improves outcomes for both parties, because she will search for more information and discover ways to make both sides better off. She isn't telling her counterparts what to think. She's asking them to dance, which is exactly what Harish Natarajan does in a debate. Since the audience started out favoring preschool subsidies, there was more room for change in Harish's direction. But he also had the more difficult task of advocating for the unpopular position. He opened the audience's mind by taking a page out of the playbook of expert negotiators. Harish started by emphasizing common ground. When he took the stage for his rebuttal, he immediately drew attention to his and Deborah's areas of agreement. He began, "So I think we disagree on far less than it may seem." He called out their alignment on the problem of poverty and on the validity of some of the studies before objecting to subsidies as a solution. "We won't have much luck changing other people's minds if we refuse to change ours. We can demonstrate openness by acknowledging where we agree with our critics and even what we've learned from them. Then, when we ask what views they might be willing to revise, we're not hypocrites." Convincing other people to think again isn't just about making a good argument. It's about establishing that we have the right motives in doing so. When we concede that someone else has made a good point, we signal that we're not preachers, prosecutors, or politicians trying to advance an agenda. We're scientists trying to get to the truth. As Harish told me, "Arguments are often far more combative and adversarial than they need to be. You should be willing to listen to what someone else is saying and give them a lot of credit for it. It makes you sound like a reasonable person who is taking everything into account." Being reasonable literally means that we can be reasoned with, that we're open to evolving our views in light of logic and data. So in the debate with Harish, why did Deborah neglect to do that? Why did she overlook common ground? It's not because Deborah is 8 years old. It's because she isn't human. Deborah Jo Prechtet is an anagram I invented. Her official name is Project Debater, and she's a machine. More specifically, an artificial intelligence developed by IBM to do for debate what Watson did for chess. They first dreamed up the idea in 2011 and started working intensively on it in 2014. Just a few years later, Project Debater had developed the remarkable ability to conduct an intelligent debate in public, complete with facts, coherent sentences, and even counterarguments. Her knowledge corpus consists of 400 million articles, largely from credible newspapers and magazines, and her claim detection engine is designed to locate key arguments, identify their boundaries, and weigh the evidence. For any debate topic, she can instantaneously search her knowledge graph for relevant data points, mold them into a logical case, and deliver it clearly, even entertainingly, in a female voice within the time constraints. Her first words in the preschool subsidy debate were, "Greetings, Harish. I've heard you hold the world record in debate competition wins against humans, but I suspect you've never debated a machine. Welcome to the future." Of course, it's possible that Harish won because the audience was biased against the computer and rooting for the human. It's worth noting, though, that Harish's approach in that debate is the same one that he's used to defeat countless humans on international stages. What amazes me is that the computer was able to master multiple complex capabilities while completely missing this crucial one. After studying 10 billion sentences, a computer was able to say something funny, a skill that's normally thought to be confined to sentient beings with high levels of social and emotional intelligence. The computer had learned to make a logical argument and even anticipate the other side's counterargument. Yet it hadn't learned to agree with elements of the other side's argument, apparently because that behavior was all too rarely deployed across 400 million articles by humans. They were usually too busy preaching their arguments, prosecuting their enemies, or politicking for audience support to grant a valid point from the other side. When I asked Harish how to improve at finding common ground, he offered a surprisingly practical tip. Most people immediately start with a straw man, poking holes in the weakest version of the other side's case. He does the reverse. He considers the strongest version of their case, which is known as the steel man. A politician might occasionally adopt that tactic to pander or persuade, but like a good scientist, Harish does it to learn. Instead of trying to dismantle the argument that preschool is good for kids, Harish accepted that the point was valid, which allowed him to relate to his opponent's perspective and to the audience's. Then it was perfectly fair and balanced for him to express his concerns about whether a subsidy would give the most underprivileged kids access to preschool. Drawing attention to common ground and avoiding defend attack spirals weren't the only ways in which Harish resembled expert negotiators. He was also careful not to come on too strong. Harish's next advantage stemmed from one of his disadvantages. He would never have access to as many facts as the computer. When the audience was polled afterward about who taught them more, the overwhelming majority said they learned more from the computer than from Harish. But it was Harish who succeeded in swaying their opinions. Why? The computer piled on study after study to support a long list of reasons in favor of preschool subsidies. Like a skilled negotiator, Harish focused on just two reasons against them. He knew that making too many points could come at the cost of developing, elaborating, and reinforcing his best ones. As he told me, if you have too many arguments, you'll dilute the power of each and every one. They are going to be less well explained, and I don't know if any of them will land enough. I don't think the audience will believe them to be important enough. Most top debaters aren't citing a lot of information. Is this always the best way to approach a debate? The answer is, like pretty much everything else in social science, it depends. The ideal number of reasons varies from one circumstance to another. There are times when preaching and prosecuting can make us more persuasive. Research suggests that the effectiveness of these approaches hinges on three key factors: how much people care about the issue, how open they are to our particular argument, and how strong-willed they are in general. If they're not invested in the issue, or they're receptive to our perspective, more reasons can help. People tend to see quantity as a sign of quality. The more the topic matters to them, the more the quality of reasons matters. It's when audiences are skeptical of our view, have a stake in the issue, and tend to be stubborn that piling on justifications is most likely to backfire. If they're resistant to rethinking, more reasons simply give them more ammunition to shoot our views down. It's not just about the number of reasons, though. It's also how they fit together. A university once approached me to see if I could bring in donations from alumni who had never given a dime. My colleagues and I ran an experiment testing two different messages meant to convince thousands of resistant alumni to give. One message emphasized the opportunity to do good. Donating would benefit students, faculty, and staff. The other emphasized the opportunity to feel good. Donors would enjoy the warm glow of giving. The two messages were equally effective. In both cases, 6.5% of the stingy alumni ended up donating. Then we combined them, because two reasons are better than one. Except they weren't. When we put the two reasons together, the giving rate dropped below 3%. Each reason alone was more than twice as effective as the two combined. The audience was already skeptical. When we gave them different kinds of reasons to donate, we triggered their awareness that someone was trying to persuade them, and they shielded themselves against it. A single line of argument feels like a conversation. Multiple lines of argument can become an onslaught. The audience tuned out the preacher and summoned their best defense attorney to refute the prosecutor. As important as the quantity and quality of reasons might be, the source matters too. And the most convincing source is often the one closest to your audience. A student in one of my classes, Rachel Penny, noticed that although top college basketball teams have rabid fans, there are usually empty seats in their arenas. To study strategies for motivating more fans to show up, we launched an experiment in the week before an upcoming game, targeting hundreds of season ticket holders. When left to their own devices, 77% of these supposedly diehard fans actually made it to the game. We decided that the most persuasive message would come from the team itself. So we sent fans an email with quotes from players and coaches about how part of the home court advantage stems from the energy of a packed house of cheering fans. It had no effect whatsoever. Attendance in that group was 76%. What did move the needle was an email with a different approach. We simply asked fans one question. Are you planning to attend? Attendance climbed to 85%. The question gave fans the freedom to make their own case for going. Psychologists have long found that the person most likely to persuade you to change your mind is you. You get to pick the reasons you find most compelling, and you come away with a real sense of ownership over them. That's where Harish's final edge came in. In every round, he posed more questions to contemplate. The computer spoke in declarative sentences, asking just a single question in the opening statement and directing it at Harish rather than at the audience. In his opening, Harish asked six different questions for the audience to ponder. Within the first minute, he asserted that just because preschools are good doesn't mean that they should be funded by the government, and then inquired, "Why is that the case?" He went on to ask whether preschools were underprovided, whether they did help the most disadvantaged, and then why they didn't, why they were so costly, and who they actually helped instead. Taken together, these techniques increase the odds that during a disagreement, other people will abandon an overconfidence cycle and engage in a rethinking cycle. When we point out that there are areas where we agree and acknowledge that they have some valid points, we model confident humility and encourage them to follow suit. When we support our argument with a small number of cohesive, compelling reasons, we encourage them to start doubting their own opinion. And when we ask genuine questions, we leave them intrigued to learn more. We don't have to convince them that we're right. We just need to open their minds to the possibility that they might be wrong. Their natural curiosity might do the rest. That said, these steps aren't always enough. No matter how nicely we ask, other people don't always want to dance. Sometimes they're so attached to their beliefs that the mere suggestion of getting in sync feels like an ambush. What do we do then? Some years ago, a Wall Street firm brought me in to consult on a project to attract and retain junior analysts and associates. After 2 months of research, I submitted a report with 26 data-driven recommendations. In the middle of my presentation to the leadership team, one of the members interrupted and asked, "Why don't we just pay them more?" I told him money alone probably wouldn't make a difference. Many studies across a range of industries have shown that once people are earning enough to meet their basic needs, paying them more doesn't stop them from leaving bad jobs and bad bosses. The executive started arguing with me. "That's not what I've found in my experience." I fired back in prosecutor mode. "Yes, that's why I brought you randomized controlled experiments with longitudinal data, to learn rigorously from many people's experiences, not idiosyncratically from yours." The executive pushed back, insisting that his company was different. So I rattled off some basic statistics from his own employees. In surveys and interviews, a grand total of zero had even mentioned compensation. They were already well paid, in other words, overpaid, and if that could have solved the problem, it already would have. Pay isn't a carrot we need to dangle to motivate people. It's a symbol of how much we value them. But the executive still refused to budge. Finally, I became so exasperated that I did something out of character. I shot back, "I've never seen a group of smart people act so dumb." In the hierarchy of disagreement created by computer scientist Paul Graham, the highest form of argument is refuting the central point, and the lowest is name-calling. In a matter of seconds, I devolved from logic bully to playground bully. If I could do that session over, I'd start with common ground and fewer data points. Instead of attacking their beliefs with my research, I'd ask them what would open their minds to my data. A few years later, I had a chance to test that approach. During a keynote speech on creativity, I cited evidence that Beethoven and Mozart didn't have higher hit rates than some of their peers. They generated a larger volume of work, which gave them more shots at greatness. A member of the audience interrupted, "Bullshit! You're disrespecting the great masters of music! You're totally ignorant! You don't know what you're talking about!" Instead of reacting right then, I waited a few minutes until a scheduled break, and then made my way to my heckler. I said, "You're welcome to disagree with the data, but I don't think that's a respectful way to express your opinion. It's not how I was trained to have an intellectual debate, were you?" The music man said, "Well, no, I just think you're wrong." I replied, "It's not my opinion. It's the independent finding of two different social scientists. What evidence would change your mind?" The music man said, I don't believe you can quantify a musician's greatness, but I'd like to see the research. When I sent him the study, he responded with an apology. I don't know if I succeeded in changing his mind, but I'd done a better job of opening it. When someone becomes hostile, if you respond by viewing the argument as a war, you can either attack or retreat. If instead you treat it as a dance, you have another option. You can sidestep. Having a conversation about the conversation shifts attention away from the substance of the disagreement and toward the process for having a dialogue. The more anger and hostility the other person expresses, the more curiosity and interest you show. When someone is losing control, your tranquility is a sign of strength. It takes the wind out of their emotional sails. It's pretty rare for someone to respond by screaming, "Screaming is my preferred mode of communication!" This is a fifth move that expert negotiators made more often than average negotiators. They were more likely to comment on their feelings about the process and test their understanding of the other side's feelings. I'm disappointed in the way this discussion has unfolded. Are you frustrated with it? I was hoping you'd see this proposal as fair. Do I understand correctly that you don't see any merit in this approach at all? Honestly, I'm a little confused by your reaction to my data. If you don't value the kind of work I do, why did you hire me? In a heated argument, you can always stop and ask, what evidence would change your mind? If the answer is nothing, then there's no point in continuing the debate. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it think. When we hit a brick wall in a debate, we don't have to stop talking altogether. Let's agree to disagree shouldn't end a discussion. It should start a new conversation with a focus on understanding and learning rather than arguing and persuading. That's what we'd do in scientist mode. Take the long view and ask how we could have handled the debate more effectively. Doing so might land us in a better position to make the same case to a different person, or to make a different case to the same person on a different day. When I asked one of the Wall Street executives for advice on how to approach debates differently in the future, he suggested expressing less conviction. I could have easily countered that I was uncertain about which of my 26 recommendations might be relevant. I could have also conceded that although money didn't usually solve the problem, I'd never seen anyone test the effect of million-dollar retention bonuses. That would be a fun experiment to run, don't you think? A few years ago, I argued in my book Originals that if we want to fight groupthink, it helps to have, quote, strong opinions weakly held. Since then, I've changed my mind. I now believe that's a mistake. If we hold an opinion weakly, expressing it strongly can backfire. Communicating it with some uncertainty signals confident humility, invites curiosity, and leads to a more nuanced discussion. Research shows that in courtrooms, expert witnesses and deliberating jurors are more credible and more persuasive when they express moderate confidence rather than high or low confidence. And these principles aren't limited to debates. They apply in a wide range of situations where we're advocating for our beliefs or even for ourselves. In 2014, a young woman named Michelle Hansen came across a job opening for a product manager at an investment company. She was excited about the position, but she wasn't qualified for it. She had no background in finance and lacked the required number of years of experience. If you were in her shoes and you decided to go for it, what would you say in your cover letter? The natural starting point would be to emphasize your strengths and downplay your weaknesses. As Michael Scott deadpanned on The Office, "I work too hard, I care too much, and sometimes I can be too invested in my job." But Michelle Hansen did the opposite, taking a page out of the George Costanza playbook on Seinfeld. "My name is George. I'm unemployed, and I live with my parents." Rather than trying to hide her shortcomings, Michelle opened with them. Her cover letter began, "I'm probably not the candidate you've been envisioning. I don't have a decade of experience as a product manager, nor am I a certified financial planner." After establishing the drawbacks of her case, she emphasized a few reasons to hire her anyway. "But what I do have are skills that can't be taught. I take ownership of projects far beyond my pay grade and what is in my defined scope of responsibilities. I don't wait for people to tell me what to do. I go seek for myself what needs to be done. I invest myself deeply in my projects, and it shows in everything I do, from my projects at work to my projects that I undertake on my own time at night. I'm entrepreneurial, I get things done, and I know I would make an excellent right hand for the co-founder leading this project. I love breaking new ground and starting with a blank slate. and any of my previous bosses would be able to attest to these traits. A week later, a recruiter contacted her for a phone screen, and then she had another phone screen with the team. On the calls, she asked about experiments they'd run recently that had surprised them. The question itself surprised the team. They ended up talking about times when they were sure they were right, but were later proven wrong. Michelle got the job, thrived, and was promoted to lead product development. The success isn't unique to her. There's evidence that people are more interested in hiring candidates who acknowledge legitimate weaknesses, as opposed to bragging or humble bragging. Even after recognizing that she was fighting an uphill battle, Michelle didn't go on defense or offense. She didn't preach her qualifications or prosecute the problems with the job description. By agreeing with the argument against her in her cover letter, she preempted knee-jerk rejection, demonstrating that she was self-aware enough to discern her shortcomings and secure enough to admit them. An informed audience is going to spot the holes in our case anyway. We might as well get credit for having the humility to look for them, the foresight to spot them, and the integrity to acknowledge them. By emphasizing a small number of core strengths, Michelle avoided argument dilution, focusing attention on her strongest points. And by showing curiosity about times the team had been wrong, she may have motivated them to rethink their criteria. They realized they weren't looking for a set of skills and credentials. They were looking to hire a human being with the motivation and ability to learn. Michelle knew what she didn't know and had the confidence to admit it, which sent a clear signal that she could learn what she needed to know. By asking questions rather than thinking for the audience, we invite them to join us as a partner and think for themselves. If we approach an argument as a war, there will be winners and losers. If we see it more as a dance, we can begin to choreograph a way forward. By considering the strongest version of an opponent's perspective and limiting our responses to our few best steps, we have a better chance of finding a rhythm. Chapter 6. Bad Blood on the Diamond: Diminishing Prejudice by Destabilizing Stereotypes. Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote, "I hated the Yankees with all my heart, even to the point of having to confess in my first holy confession that I wished harm to others. Namely, that I wished various New York Yankees would break arms, legs, and ankles." One afternoon in Maryland in 1983, Daryl Davis arrived at a lounge to play the piano at a country music gig. It wasn't his first time being the only black man in the room. Before the night was out, it would be his first time having a conversation with a white supremacist. After the show, an older white man in the audience walked up to Daryl and told him that he was astonished to see a black musician play like Jerry Lee Lewis. Daryl replied that he and Lewis were in fact friends, and that Lewis himself had acknowledged that his style was influenced by black musicians. Although the man was skeptical, he invited Daryl to sit down for a drink. Soon, the man was admitting that he'd never had a drink with a black person before. Eventually, he explained to Daryl why. He was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, the white supremacist hate group that had been murdering African Americans for over a century and had lynched a man just 2 years earlier. If you found yourself sitting down with someone who hated you and all people who shared your skin color, your instinctive options might be fight, flight, or freeze, and rightfully so. Daryl had a different reaction. He burst out laughing. When the man pulled out his KKK membership card to show he wasn't joking, Daryl returned to a question that had been on his mind since he was 10 years old. In the late 1960s, he was marching in a Cub Scout parade when white spectators started throwing cans, rocks, and bottles at him. It was the first time he remembers facing overt racism, and although he could justifiably have gotten angry, he was bewildered. "How can you hate me when you don't even know me?" At the end of the conversation, the Klansman handed Daryl his phone number and asked if he would call him whenever he was playing locally. Daryl followed up, and the next month, the man showed up with a bunch of his friends to see Daryl perform. Over time, a friendship grew, and the man ended up leaving the KKK. That was a turning point in Daryl's life, too. It wasn't long before Daryl was sitting down with Imperial Wizards and Grand Dragons, the Klan's highest officers, to ask his question. Since then, Daryl has convinced many white supremacists to leave the KKK and abandon their hatred. I wanted to understand how that kind of change happens, how to break over confidence cycles that are steeped in stereotypes and prejudice about entire groups of people. Strangely enough, my journey started at a baseball game. Yankees suck! Yankees suck! It was a summer night at Fenway Park, my first and only time at a Boston Red Sox baseball game. In the seventh inning, without warning, 37,000 people erupted into a chant. The entire stadium was dissing the New York Yankees in perfect harmony. I knew the two teams had a century-long rivalry, widely viewed as the most heated in all of American professional sports. I took it for granted that the Boston fans would root against the Yankees. I just didn't expect it to happen that day, because the Yankees weren't even there. The Red Sox were playing against the Oakland A's. The Boston fans were booing a team that was hundreds of miles away. It was as if Burger King fans were going head-to-head against Wendy's in a taste test and started chanting, "McDonald's sucks!" I started to wonder if Red Sox fans hate the Yankees more than they love their own team. Boston parents have been known to teach their kids to flip the bird at the Yankees and to test anything in pinstripes, and "Yankees suck" is apparently among the most popular t-shirts in Boston history. When asked how much money it would take to get them to taunt their own team, Red Sox fans requested an average of $503. To root for the Yankees, they wanted even more, $560. The feelings run so deep that neuroscientists can watch them light up people's minds. When Red Sox fans see the Yankees fail, they show immediate activation in brain regions linked to reward and pleasure. Those feelings extend well beyond Boston. In a 2019 analysis of tweets, the Yankees were the most hated baseball team in 28 of the 50 U.S. states, which may explain the popularity of the t-shirt, "Mommy told me never to talk to strangers or Yankees fans." I recently called a friend who's a diehard Red Sox fan with a simple question. What would it take to get him to root for the Yankees? Without pausing, he said, "If they were playing Al-Qaeda, maybe." It's one thing to love your team. It's another to hate your rivals so much that you'd consider rooting for terrorists to crush them. If you despise a particular sports team and its fans, you're harboring some strong opinions about a group of people. Those beliefs are stereotypes, and they often spill over into prejudice. The stronger your attitudes become, the less likely you are to rethink them. Rivalries aren't unique to sports. A rivalry exists whenever we reserve special animosity for a group we see as competing with us for resources or threatening our identities. In business, the rivalry between footwear companies Puma and Adidas was so intense that for generations, families self-segregated based on their allegiance to the brands. They went to different bakeries, pubs, and shops, and even refused to date people who worked for the rival firm. In politics, you probably know some Democrats who view Republicans as being greedy, ignorant, heartless cretins, and some Republicans who regard Democrats as lazy, dishonest, hypersensitive snowflakes. As stereotypes stick and prejudice deepens, we don't just identify with our own group. We disidentify with our adversaries, coming to define who we are by what we're not. We don't just preach the virtues of our side. We find self-worth in prosecuting the vices of our rivals. When people hold prejudice toward a rival group, they're often willing to do whatever it takes to elevate their own group and undermine their rivals, even if it means doing harm or doing wrong. We see people cross those lines regularly in sports rivalries. When Monica Seles was stabbed on a tennis court in 1993, I know at least one Steffi Graf fan who celebrated. In the 2019 NBA Finals, when Kevin Durant went down with an injury, some Toronto Raptors fans started cheering, proving that even Canadians are capable of cruelty. With all due respect, if you care more about whether your team wins a game than whether a human being is hurt in real life, you might be a sociopath. Aggression extends well beyond the playing field. From Barcelona to Brazil, fistfights frequently break out between soccer fans. Cheating scandals are rampant too, and they aren't limited to athletes or coaches. When students at The Ohio State University were paid to participate in an experiment, they learned that if they were willing to lie to a student from a different school, their own pay would double, and the other student's compensation would be cut in half. Their odds of lying quadrupled if the student attended the University of Michigan, their biggest rival, rather than Berkeley or Virginia. Why do people form stereotypes about rival groups in the first place? And what does it take to get them to rethink them? For decades, psychologists have found that people can feel animosity toward other groups even when the boundaries between them are trivial. Take a seemingly innocuous question. Is a hot dog a sandwich? When students answered this question, Most felt strongly enough that they were willing to sacrifice a dollar to those who agreed with them to make sure those who disagreed got less. In every human society, people are motivated to seek belonging and status. Identifying with a group checks both boxes at the same time. We become part of a tribe, and we take pride when our tribe wins. In classic studies on college campuses, psychologists found that after their team won a football game, students were more likely to walk around wearing school swag. From Arizona State to Notre Dame to USC, students basked in the reflected glory of Saturday victories, donning team shirts and hats and jackets on Sunday. If their team lost, they shunned school apparel and distanced themselves by saying, "they lost," instead of, "we lost." Although this is the subject of extensive debate, some economists and finance experts have even found that the stock market rises if a country's soccer team wins World Cup matches and falls if they lose. Rivalries are more likely to develop between teams that are geographically close, compete regularly, and are evenly matched. The Yankees and Red Sox fit this pattern. They're both on the East Coast, they play each other 18 or 19 times a season, they both have histories of success, and they've competed over 2,000 times, with each team winning over 1,000 times. The two teams also have more fans than any other franchises in baseball. I decided to test what it would take to get fans to rethink their beliefs about their bitter rivals. Working with a doctoral student, Tim Kundrow, I ran a series of experiments with passionate Yankees and Red Sox supporters. To get a sense of their stereotypes, we asked over 1,000 Red Sox and Yankees fans to list 3 negative things about their rivals. They mostly used the same words to describe one another: obnoxious, arrogant, loud, annoying, aggressive. They complained about each other's respective accents, their beards, and their tendency to, quote, "smell like old corn chips." Once we've formed those kinds of stereotypes, for both mental and social reasons, it's hard to undo them. Psychologist George Kelly observed that our beliefs are like pairs of reality goggles. We use them to make sense of the world and navigate our surroundings. A threat to our opinions cracks our goggles, leaving our vision blurred. It's only natural to put up our guard in response. And Kelly noticed that we become especially hostile when trying to defend opinions that we know deep down are false. Rather than trying on a different pair of goggles, we become mental contortionists, twisting and turning until we find an angle of vision that keeps our current views intact. Socially, there's another reason stereotypes are so sticky. We tend to interact with people who share them, which makes them even more extreme. This phenomenon is called group polarization, and it's been demonstrated in hundreds of experiments. Juries with authoritarian beliefs recommend harsher punishments after deliberating together. Corporate boards are more likely to support paying outlandish premiums for companies after group discussions. Citizens who start out with a clear belief on affirmative action and gay marriage develop more extreme views on these issues after talking with a few others who share their stance. Their preaching and prosecuting move in the direction of their politics. Polarization is reinforced by conformity. Peripheral members fit in and gain status by following the lead of the most prototypical member of the group, who often holds the most intense views. Grow up in a family of Red Sox fans, and you're bound to hear some unpleasant things about Yankees fans. Start making regular trips to a ballpark packed with people who share your loathing, and it's only a matter of time before your contempt intensifies and calcifies. Once that happens, you're motivated to see the best in your team and the worst in your opponent. Evidence shows that when teams try to downplay a rivalry by reminding fans that it's just a game, it backfires. Fans feel their identity is being devalued and actually become more aggressive. My first idea for disrupting this pattern came from outer space. If you ever leave the planet Earth, you'll probably end up rethinking some of your feelings about other human beings. A team of psychologists has studied the effects of outer space on inner space, assessing the changes in more than 100 astronauts and cosmonauts through interviews, surveys, and analyses of autobiographies. Upon returning from space, astronauts are less focused on individual achievements and personal happiness, and more concerned about the collective good. As Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell reflected, "You develop an instant global consciousness, an intense dissatisfaction with the state of the world, and a compulsion to do something about it. From out there on the moon, international politics looks so petty. You want to grab a politician by the scruff of the neck and drag him 250,000 miles out and say, 'Look at that, you son of a b-.'" This reaction is known as the overview effect. The astronaut who described it most vividly to me is Space Shuttle Commander Jeff Ashby. He recalled that the first time he looked back at the Earth from outer space, it changed him forever. Quote, "On Earth, astronauts look to the stars. Most of us are star fanatics. But in space, the stars look the same as they do on Earth. What is so different is the planet, the perspective that it gives you. My first glimpse of the Earth from space was about 15 minutes into my first flight, when I looked up from my checklist, and suddenly we were over the lit part of the Earth with our windows facing down. Below me was the continent of Africa, and it was moving by much as a city would move by from an airline seat. Circling the entire planet in 90 minutes, you see that thin blue arc of the atmosphere. Seeing how fragile the little layer is in which all of humankind exists, you can easily, from space, see the connection between someone on one side of the planet to someone on the other, and there are no borders evident. So it appears as just this one common layer that we all exist in. When you get to see an overview of the Earth from outer space, you realize you share a common identity with all human beings. I wanted to create a version of the overview effect for baseball fans. There's some evidence that common identity can build bridges between rivals. In one experiment, psychologists randomly assigned Manchester United soccer fans a short writing task. They then staged an emergency in which a passing runner slipped and fell, screaming in pain as he held his ankle. He was wearing the t-shirt of their biggest rival, and the question was whether they would stop to help him. If the soccer fans had just written about why they loved their team, only 30% helped. If they had written about what they had in common with other soccer fans, 70% helped. When Tim and I tried to get Red Sox and Yankees fans to reflect on their common identity as baseball fans, it didn't work. They didn't end up with more positive views of one another or a greater willingness to help one another outside emergency situations. Shared identity doesn't stick in every circumstance. If a rival fan has just had an accident, thinking about a common identity might motivate us to help. If he's not in danger or dire need, though, it's too easy to dismiss him as just another jerk or not our responsibility. As one Red Sox supporter commented, "We both love baseball. The Yankees fans just like the wrong team." Another stated that their shared love of baseball had no effect on his opinions. The Yankees suck and their fans are annoying. I next turn to the psychology of peace. Years ago, the pioneering psychologist and Holocaust survivor Herb Kelman set out to challenge some of the stereotypes behind the Israel-Palestine conflict by teaching the two sides to understand and empathize with one another. He designed interactive problem-solving workshops in which influential Israeli and Palestinian leaders talked off the record about paths to peace. For years, they came together to share their own experiences and perspectives, address one another's needs and fears, and explore novel solutions to the conflict. Over time, the workshops didn't just shatter stereotypes. Some of the participants ended up forming lifelong friendships. Humanizing the other side should be much easier in sports because the stakes are lower and the playing field is more level. I started with another of the biggest rivalries in sports, UNC-Duke. I asked Shane Battier, who led Duke to an NCAA basketball championship in 2001, what it would take for him to root for UNC. His immediate reply? If they were playing the Taliban. I had no idea so many people fantasized about crushing terrorists in their favorite sport. I wondered whether humanizing a Duke student would change UNC students' stereotypes of the group. In an experiment with my colleagues Allison Fergale and Karen Knowlton, we asked UNC students to help improve the job application of a peer. If we mentioned that he went to Duke rather than UNC, as long as he was facing significant financial need, participants spent extra time helping him. Once they felt empathy for his plight, they saw him as a unique individual deserving of assistance and liked him more. Yet when we measured their views of Duke students in general, the UNC students were just as likely to see them as their rivals, to say that it felt like a personal compliment if they heard someone criticize Duke, and to take it as a personal insult if they heard Duke praised. We had succeeded in changing their attitudes toward the student, but failed in changing their stereotypes of the group. Something similar happened when Tim and I tried to humanize a Yankees fan. We had Red Sox fans read a story written by a baseball buff who'd learned the game as a child with his grandfather and had fond memories of playing catch with his mom. At the very end of the piece, he mentioned that he was a diehard supporter of the Yankees. One Red Sox supporter commented, "I think this person is very authentic and is a rare Yankee fan." A second observed, This person gets it and is not your typical Yankee fan. A third fan lamented, "Ugh, I really liked this text until I got to the part about them being a Yankees fan. I think this particular person I would have more in common with than the typical, stereotypical Yankees fan. This person is okay." Herb Kelman ran into the same problem with Israelis and Palestinians. In the problem-solving workshops, they came to trust the individuals across the table, but they still held on to their stereotypes of the group. In an ideal world, learning about individual group members will humanize the group. But often, getting to know a person better just establishes her as different from the rest of her group. When we meet group members who defy a stereotype, our first instinct isn't to see them as exemplars and rethink the stereotype. It's to see them as exceptions and cling to our existing beliefs. So that attempt also failed. Back to the drawing board again. My all-time favorite commercial starts with a close-up of a man and a woman kissing. As the camera zooms out, you see that he's wearing an Ohio State Buckeyes sweatshirt, and she's wearing a Michigan Wolverines t-shirt. The caption, "Without sports, this wouldn't be disgusting." As a lifelong Wolverine fan, I was raised to boo at Buckeye fans. My uncle filled his basement with Michigan paraphernalia, got up at 3 a.m. on Saturdays to start setting up for tailgates, and drove a van with the Michigan logo emblazoned on the side. When I went back home to Michigan for grad school, and one of my college roommates started medical school at Ohio State, it was only natural for me to preach my school's superiority by phone and prosecute his intelligence by text. A few years ago, I got to know an unusually kind woman in her 70s who works with Holocaust survivors. Last summer, when she mentioned that she had gone to Ohio State, my first response was, "Yuck." My next reaction was to be disgusted with myself. Who cares where she went to school half a century ago? How did I get programmed this way? Suddenly, it seemed odd that anyone would hate a team at all. In ancient Greece, Plutarch wrote of a wooden ship that Theseus sailed from Crete to Athens. To preserve the ship, as its old planks decayed, Athenians would replace them with new wood. Eventually, all the planks had been replaced. It looked like the same ship, but none of its parts was the same. Was it still the same ship? Later, philosophers added a wrinkle. If you collected all the original planks and fashioned them into a ship, would that be the same ship? The ship of Theseus has a lot in common with a sports franchise. If you hail from Boston, you might hate the 1920 Yankees for taking Babe Ruth or the 1978 Yankees for dashing your World Series hopes. Although the current team carries the same name, the pieces are different. The players are long gone. So are the managers and coaches. The stadium's been replaced. As Jerry Seinfeld quipped, "You're actually rooting for the clothes." Fans will be so in love with a player, but if he goes to a different team, they boo him. This is the same human being in a different shirt. They hate him now. Boo! Different shirt! Boo! I think it's a ritual. A fun but arbitrary ritual. A ceremony that we perform out of habit. We imprinted on it when we were young and impressionable, or we're new to a city and looking for esprit de corps. Sure, there are moments when team loyalty does matter in our lives. It allows us to high-five acquaintances at bars and hug strangers at victory parades. It gives us a sense of solidarity. If you reflect on it, though, hating an opposing team is an accident of birth. If you had been born in New York instead of Boston, would you really hate the Yankees? For our third approach, Tim and I recruited fans of the Red Sox and Yankees. To prove their allegiance, they had to correctly name one of their team's players from a photo, and the last year his team had won the World Series. Then we took some steps to open their minds. First, to help them recognize the complexity of their own beliefs, we asked them to list three positives and three negatives about fans of the opposing team. You heard some of the most common negatives earlier, but they were able to come up with some positives too. They called each other passionate, dedicated, and loyal. Then we randomly assigned half of them to go the extra step of reflecting on the arbitrariness of their animosity. We asked them to think and write about how Yankee fans and Red Sox fans dislike each other for reasons that are fairly arbitrary. For example, if you were born into a family of fans of the rival team, you would likely also be a fan of them today. To gauge their animosity toward their opponents, we gave them a chance to decide how spicy the hot sauce sold in the rival team's stadium should be. The backstory was that consumer product researchers were planning to do taste tests of hot sauces in baseball stadiums. People who were randomly assigned to reflect on the arbitrariness of their stereotypes selected less fiery hot sauce for their rival stadium. We also gave them a chance to sabotage a rival fan's performance on a time-paid math test by assigning harder problems. And those who considered the arbitrariness of their stereotypes picked easier questions for the rival fan. People weren't just more sympathetic toward a single fan. They changed their views toward their rival team as a whole. They were less likely to see their rival's failure as their success, their rival's success as a personal insult, and criticism of their rival as a personal compliment. And they were more likely to support their rival team in ways that would normally be unthinkable. Wearing the rival team's jerseys, sitting in its dugout at games, voting for its players in the All-Star game, and even endorsing the team on social media. For some fans, it was almost like breaking a religious code, but their comments made it clear that they were rethinking their stances. One wrote, "I think it is pretty dumb to hate someone just based on the sports teams they enjoy supporting. Thinking about that makes me want to reconsider how I feel about some supporters of teams that I dislike." Another wrote, "If someone hated me because of the team that I loved, it would feel unfair. Almost like a form of prejudice, because they are judging me based on one thing about me and hating me for that reason. After feeling these thoughts, I may change the way I interact with Red Sox fans." A third wrote, "The team they support is not necessarily indicative of who they are, even though they are wrong." We'd finally made some progress. Our next step was to examine the key ingredients behind the shift in fans' views. We found that it was thinking about the arbitrariness of their animosity, not the positive qualities of their rival, that mattered. Regardless of whether they generated reasons to like their rivals, fans showed less hostility when they reflected on how silly the rivalry was. Knowing what it felt like to be disliked for ridiculous reasons helped them see that this conflict had real implications, that hatred for opposing fans isn't all fun and games. Outside the lab, dismantling stereotypes and decreasing prejudice rarely happen overnight. Even if people aren't on guard from the start, they're quick to put their defenses up when their attitudes are challenged. Getting through to them requires more than just telling them that their views are arbitrary. A key step is getting them to do some counterfactual thinking, helping them consider what they'd believe if they were living in an alternative reality. In psychology, counterfactual thinking involves imagining how the circumstances of our lives could have unfolded differently. When we realize how easily we could have held different stereotypes, we might be more willing to update our views. To activate counterfactual thinking, you might ask people questions like, "How would your stereotypes be different if you'd been born Black, Hispanic, Asian, or Native American? What opinions would you hold if you'd been raised on a farm versus in a city, or in a culture on the other side of the world? What beliefs would you cling to if you lived in the 1700s? You've already learned from debate champions and expert negotiators that asking people questions can motivate them to rethink their conclusions. What's different about these kinds of counterfactual questions is that they invite people to explore the origins of their own beliefs and reconsider their stances toward other groups. People gain humility when they reflect on how different circumstances could have led them to different beliefs. They might conclude that some of their past convictions had been too simplistic and begin to question some of their negative views. That doubt could leave them more curious about groups they've stereotyped, and they might end up discovering some unexpected commonalities. Recently, I stumbled onto an opportunity to encourage some counterfactual thinking. A startup founder asked me to join an all-hands meeting to share insights on how to better understand other people's personalities and their own. During our virtual fireside chat, she mentioned that she was an astrology fan and the company was full of them. I wondered if I could get some of them to see that they held inaccurate stereotypes about people based on the month in which they happened to be born. I told her there's no evidence whatsoever that astrology has anything to do with personality, and she told me that was such a Capricorn thing to say. I, of course, then told her I think I'm a Leo, and I asked her what evidence would change her mind. And she said, "Well, my partner's been trying for as long as we've been dating, and he's given up. There's nothing that can convince me otherwise." So I told her, "You're not thinking like a scientist. This is a religion for you." And she admitted, "Yeah, well, maybe a little." That was my opening. I asked her what if she'd been born in China instead of the US. I told her about some new evidence that if you're a Virgo in China, you get discriminated against in hiring and also in dating. These poor Virgos are stereotyped as being difficult and ornery. Yep, psychologists have actually studied this recently and found that the arbitrary names of zodiac signs can give rise to stereotypes and discrimination. Virgo is translated into Chinese as virgin, which calls to mind prejudice against old virgins, spinsters, as critical, germophobic, fussy, and picky. The founder jumped in and said, in the West, that same discrimination happens to Scorpios. Although the founder started out resistant to my argument, after considering how she might hold different stereotypes if she lived in China, she recognized a familiar pattern. She'd seen an entire group of people mistreated as a result of the positions of the sun and the moon on the day they happened to enter the world. Realizing how unfair discrimination based on zodiac signs was, the founder ended up jumping in to help me build my case. As we wrapped up the conversation, I offered to do a follow-up discussion on the science of personality. More than a quarter of the company signed up to participate. Afterward, one of the participants wrote, quote, "The biggest takeaway from this chat is the importance of unlearning things to avoid being ignorant." Having grasped how arbitrary their stereotypes were, people were now more open to rethinking their views. Psychologists find that many of our beliefs are cultural truisms, widely shared but rarely questioned. If we take a closer look at them, we often discover that they rest on shaky foundations. Stereotypes don't have the structural integrity of a carefully built ship. They're more like a tower in the game of Jenga, teetering on a small number of blocks, with some key supports missing. To knock it over, sometimes all we need to do is give it a poke. The hope is that people will rise to the occasion and build new beliefs on a stronger foundation. Can this approach extend to bigger divisions among people? I don't believe for a minute that it will solve the Israel-Palestine conflict or stop racism. I do think it's a step, though, towards something more fundamental than merely rethinking our stereotypes. We might question the underlying belief that it makes sense to hold opinions about groups at all. If you get people to pause and reflect, they might decide that the very notion of applying group stereotypes to individuals is absurd. Research suggests that there are more similarities between groups than we recognize, and there's typically more variety within groups than between them. Sometimes letting go of stereotypes means realizing that many members of a hated group aren't so terrible after all. And that's more likely to happen when we actually come face to face with them. For over half a century, social scientists have tested the effects of intergroup contact. In a meta-analysis of over 500 studies with over 250,000 participants, interacting with members of another group reduced prejudice in 94% of the cases. Although intergroup communication isn't a panacea, that is a staggering statistic. The most effective way to help people pull the unsteady Jenga blocks out of their stereotype towers is to talk with them in person, which is precisely what Daryl Davis did. One day, Daryl was driving his car with the chief officer of a KKK chapter, whose official title was Exalted Cyclops. Before long, the Cyclops was sharing his stereotypes of black people. They were an inferior species, he said. They had smaller brains, which made them unintelligent, and a genetic predisposition toward violence. When Daryl pointed out that he was black, but had never shot anyone or stolen a car, the Cyclops told him his criminal gene must be latent. It hadn't come out yet. Daryl decided to beat the Cyclops at his own game. He challenged him to name three black serial killers. When the Cyclops couldn't name any, Daryl rattled off a long list of well-known white serial killers and told the Cyclops that he must be one. When the Cyclops protested that he'd never killed anybody, Daryl turned his own argument against him and said that his serial killer gene must be latent. The flustered Cyclops replied, "Well, that's stupid." Daryl agreed, "Well, duh, you're right. What I said about you was stupid, but no more stupid than what you said about me." The Cyclops got very quiet and changed the subject. Several months later, he told Daryl that he was still thinking about that conversation. Daryl had planted a seed of doubt and made him curious about his own beliefs. The Cyclops ended up quitting the KKK and giving his hood and robe to Daryl. Daryl is obviously extraordinary, not only in his ability to wage a one-man war on prejudice, but also in his inclination to do so. As a general rule, it's those with greater power who need to do more of the rethinking, both because they're more likely to privilege their own perspectives and because their perspectives are more likely to go unquestioned. In most cases, the oppressed and marginalized have already done a great deal of contortion to fit in. Having been the target of racism since childhood, Daryl had a lifetime of legitimate reasons to harbor animosity toward white people. He was still willing to approach white supremacists with an open mind and give them the opportunity to rethink their views. But it shouldn't have been Daryl's responsibility to challenge white supremacists and put himself at risk. In an ideal world, the Cyclops would have taken it upon himself to educate his peers. Some other former KKK members have stepped up, working independently and with Daryl to advocate for the oppressed and reform the structures that produce oppression in the first place. As we work towards systemic change, Daryl urges us not to overlook the power of conversation. When we choose not to engage with people because of their stereotypes or prejudice, we give up on opening their minds. Daryl reflects, "We are living in space-age times, yet there are still so many of us thinking with stone-age minds. Our ideology needs to catch up to our technology." He estimates that he has helped upwards of 200 white supremacists rethink their beliefs and leave the KKK and other neo-Nazi groups. Many of them have gone on to educate their families and friends. Daryl is quick to point out that he hasn't directly persuaded these men to change their minds. As he says, "I didn't convert anybody. I gave them reason to think about their direction in life, and they thought about it and thought, I need a better path, and this is the way to go." Daryl doesn't do this by preaching or prosecuting. When he begins a dialogue with white supremacists, many are initially surprised by his thoughtfulness. As they start to see him as an individual and spend more time with him, they often tap into a common identity around shared interests and topics like music. Over time, he helps them see that they joined these hate groups for reasons that weren't their own. It was a family tradition dating back multiple generations, or someone had told them that their jobs were being taken by black men. As they realize how little they truly know about other groups and how shallow stereotypes are, they start to think again. After getting to know Daryl, one Imperial wizard didn't stop at leaving the KKK. He shut down the chapter. Years later, he asked Daryl to be his daughter's godfather.